As we begin, I'd like to offer a tribute to Mel Pine's beautiful sermon last Sunday. I'm sorry that I couldn't be here to hear it, but I was deeply moved in listening to it online yesterday. I found it powerful. I think it helps to lay a foundation for what I want to say this morning, which is to remind us that the potential of the church to bring us into painful conflict is not a failure of design, which needs a fix. It's a necessary part of our spiritual life, sort of like practice if you're a musician or an athlete. In fact, that's why we often speak of spiritual practice. No amount of reading or study can substitute for practice, but of course they can help. In the end, we find our lives transformed, and that's the goal. So I think these two sermons belong together as we begin to think about Rosh Hashanah and its invitation to reconciliation and atonement. Let me begin with a story which caught Phyllis and my eyes this week in the Post, and perhaps it caught yours. It has nothing to do with atonement, literally at-one-ment, but perhaps suggests where the road in the opposite direction might lead if we're single-minded enough. It's the story of a resort developer, does this ring a bell yet, whose ambition is to offer his guests a new standard of luxury spending, a new standard in luxury spending, and to model for them what that might look like. He's building a new resort in Macau called the Louis XIII, after the French king who built Versailles. What else? Our guy is buying a fleet of 30 Rolls-Royce limos, the biggest order Rolls-Royce has ever had. With lots of extras and some gold plating here and there, they'll cost over $700,000 each. It's going to cost him a cool $20 million. They're not for himself, of course. He wants to set the standard for his guests spending at his hotel. He already has a Rolls of his own. Raising the bar in luxury spending and modeling it, focusing entirely on ourselves. Kind of sad as a life's ambition. But it does invite us to ask ourselves, what's our life ambition? What would we hope those who come after us will want to write on our headstones? I can't speak for you, but I think I have a clue. I think that when you and I, when we decided to try out a church, perhaps this one, we're not thinking of the lifestyle we could enjoy or that it would allow us to enjoy, though there is such a thing as a gospel of luxury, a gospel of prosperity, it's called. We don't preach it here. We were thinking of the difference it might help us to make in the world. We know we already have plenty of toys in this electronic age. It's hard to lay them down. I hope you turned yours off. But we also know that the measure of our lives is not our toys or our money, but our caring, guided by a vision that of life that is larger than ourselves. We were born, all of us, with God-given gifts, like that brother in Phyllis' story this morning with a beautiful voice, or the other brother with his gifts in athletics and good looks. We come together hoping that our life in the church will help us figure out our gifts and use them in the service of life itself. Ultimately, we want to give back from all that we have been given. And I see that happening all the time here among us. Sometimes our time together, well, at first, of course, we may just sit here in these pews and soak it in, may even shed a few tears at finding the sort of place we thought we'd never find, a place where, at last, we could feel accepted for who we really are. Sometimes our time together is informative, too, and even fun. But we know that it's about more than that. It's about widening our horizons and sharing our vision. It's about connecting. It's about coming to know ourselves and each other, about being known, connecting with something deeper, something more than we are. Call it God, call it life itself. In the end, it's about making a difference in each other's lives and in the world around us. And along the way, of course, one of the ways we make a difference is in caring for each other in times of sorrow and celebrating with each other in times of joy as we mark the passages in our lives. I'll grant you we might not be conscious of all this when we first head out Gleedsville Road toward this country chapel. We might just have been thinking there's something missing in my life or my children's life. And then we begin to enjoy the services and conversations, maybe even the coffee. Barbara, where are you? Our coffee seller. We take in what's happening, but soon, maybe even unconsciously, we begin to realize that something is happening to us. New windows are being opened in our lives, and our vision is being stretched. We are being stretched. You may remember the imagery of Annie Dillard, which we've spoken of once or twice here, that we should wear crash helmets to church. We should wear crash helmets to church because we're playing with fire in all this, and you never know what may happen. Something might explode. Most often, happily, we find ourselves stretched gradually, almost imperceptibly, yet sometimes the change is dramatic. Though we may not even have thought about being changed consciously, I hope my title this morning, The Upside Down Church, will remind us that at our best, we come to church in the secret hope that somehow it may open new vistas in our lives and even turn our lives upside down. For a few of us, the path leads to seminary. For others, a career change of some other sort. But for most of us, it just invites us to do what we already do with fresh eyes and a more open heart. And for all of us, it changes the quality of our lives and helps us to bless the world as we give back from all that we have been given. If you find this happening to you, be assured that it's no accident. It's what the church at its best is all about. It's not all that the church is about, but it's a main thing that the church is about. We're more than a classroom, more than a club, more than even a family, caring though we are for each other. Turning our lives upside down is one of the reasons that we exist. Yes, we celebrate much about the culture that we live in, its democratic foundation and ideals, its respect for freedom, and we exist to challenge our society to live up to these ends, as Martin Luther King did so movingly and magnificently and effectively. But we also exist to mitigate the excesses and challenge some of the assumptions of our culture. In proclaiming that caring and community are more important than power and material things, more important than entertainment and pleasure, we are proclaiming a definitely countercultural set of values while bringing meaning to our lives. And the church is even more than that. It's also a community where we try to model the growing vision that opens before us. It's not enough just to sit side by side as a bunch of individuals relating only to our vision up there, maybe the vertical axis, God and me, as we sit in those pews. We're a community as well, relating to each other and those around us. That's what I call the horizontal axis of our life together. Besides, who would take our message seriously in the world out there if we didn't practice what we preach? As a community practicing the arts of love, we are, to mix a metaphor, where the rubber meets the road. That's why I call us a school for living. So it matters how we relate to each other. The practices we bring with us from our secular lives may set a minimum for our ways of living, a standard of caring. We try to be responsible and civil and practice fairness. But our religious values set a higher ethical standard. A sermon like this may remind us of these values, but in itself, at least not many of my sermons, are going to turn life upside down. That happens only in the daily experience of living together. And in the process of coming to know ourselves and each other more deeply and strengthen our sense of connection with life itself. It can help a lot and feel safer if we come together around some mutual expectations of how we want to treat each other. Not rules to be enforced, but aspirations to which we try to hold ourselves when the road gets bumpy. And we need to stop and call ourselves back to our best. I think we're committed to moving toward a covenant like this as the months go by this year. Even with the help of such a covenant, however, it's inevitable that there will sometimes be bumps and bruises and hurt feelings. If you've been here long enough, I know that you've experienced that. But you know, that's one of the challenges of our spiritual growth, learning to say, "I'm sorry." Perhaps the two hardest words. The two hardest words in our language. And learning to forgive. This is a particularly helpful reminder at this time of Rosh Hashanah. As Catherine Kavanaugh, a Canadian chaplain, has written, "Love would be easier if we didn't also have to forgive. We need to treat others, all others, as if they were our children, whom we would forgive endlessly and forever. This is the love we reach for, a love so deep in our bones that nothing can stand in the way of forgiveness." It's hard to say, "I'm sorry," still harder to forgive, I would add. And when we've had hard words or feel betrayed, we and the other person both have to struggle with these things. But as Kavanaugh also points out, forgiveness is more about our soul than about the soul of the one who deceives us. If we cannot forgive, we are the ones whose souls fester in a prison of pain. We are the ones who suffer. No one can tell us that we have to forgive, and certainly no one can tell us when it's the right time to forgive, so that we can let go and free ourselves from that pain. But it can help enormously when we're able to speak our pain to each other and feel we've been listened to. And I might add, it also can help enormously when we allow ourselves to listen to the other person sharing that person's pain. And then we both have a chance to reflect on it and listen to our very souls in the silence of prayer. I doubt that most of us realized when we first came through these doors that we were getting into this sort of thing. I doubt that we expected our lives to be turned upside down. Then again, I doubt that we had any idea of the deep joy that we might experience as we entered into this life together, as we worked through the rough places to heal the hurts, and emerged more deeply bonded, more confident in our trust than before. We don't have to do it. We're a free church in a free land, and we can always quit. We can go join some other church or stay at home and whatever we like to do on Sunday mornings, even read the Washington Post online, of course. But when we join the church, we make an implicit moral covenant to walk together in our spiritual journeys and to stay together, come what may. To hang in there when the going gets tough and together work things out. That's where the work is, that's where the pain is, and that's where the growth is. That's where the joy comes as we do the hard work, as we learn to say, "I'm sorry," and to forgive each other and begin again in love. Some of the most deeply satisfying moments in my life have come in times like these, in getting past bruises like this in my own life, and in midwifing the process, you might say, as minister to others. I can recall times of bringing people together who were willing to come together and share the pain that they had caused each other in tears, but to experience each other's pain and to experience forgiveness. And those sessions end as they began, with tears, but this time tears of joy. It's a privilege to be able to help that process. And Phyllis and I are always available to walk with you as well in these times of hurt and anger and reaching out for reconciliation. And I don't want to suggest that the journey we share is mostly painful. Always for me, there have been many more times filled with singing and laughter, fulfillment and joy. Singing like that brothers in the story. Far more such times, I'm confident, than ever come with owning a Rolls Royce, no matter how long or how expensive or how much gold plating. And I say that as someone whose dream for many years when I was young was to at least have a Jaguar. They were less expensive in those days, but they were still pretty expensive for me. Both the bruises and the joy come with the journey into community. The journey toward that ever-expanding vision that we shape together as we share our lives and find them turned upside down. In the end, this upside-down business is about discovering our gifts, growing them, and using them and giving back to the world around us. As the great religious traditions tell us, it's in our giving that we receive and grow and find purpose and meaning in our lives. Speaking of the rule in Buddhist monasteries that monks bow to their seniors, Mel last week invited us to strengthen our own community by finding something in all those around us to admire, something we could at least metaphorically bow down to. How many were here last week? Yeah, you'll remember. For the rest of you, the sermon is online. You can listen to it. It might even be a gift that we ourselves have not acknowledged, perhaps not dared to own up to. With enough practice, our admiration of each other's sometimes hidden gifts can become a habit. And in the process can be a self-fulfilling observation, which strengthens the other person even as it builds community. And isn't that habit in itself a wonderful gift to those around us in our life outside the church? I don't mean to make light of it when I say that it reminds me of the sometimes poignant saying that I wish I were the person my dog thinks I am. You could apply that, of course, to a spouse or to what your child thinks of you. We become what others see in us. The upside-down church invites us into an upside-down life. And in the process, we may even hope to turn the world upside down, one little piece at a time. May we make the journey hand in hand. May we find the courage to face the pain, and may we find the joy. May it be so. Amen.